Mercedes-Benz Sprinter, the safest, most innovative Sprinter yet, starting at just $33,790. Built for you, the all-new Sprinter, built in the USA. Mercedes-Benz, vans, born to run.
MSRP excludes all options, taxes, title, registration, transportation charge, and dealer prep fee. Options, model availability, and actual dealer price may vary. See dealer for details about costs and terms. Equipment described as optional. 2019 Mercedes-Benz Sprinter, available soon.
President Trump says he'll nominate Stephen Moore to fill the vacancy on the board of the Fed Reserve. Trump made the announcement shortly after landing in Florida this afternoon. Moore is an economic policy analyst and fiscal conservative who's been also critical of Fed Chair Jerome Powell. An eye-opening survey on Americans' religious identities. And here with the findings, USA Radio Network's Chris Barnes. Losing my
religion. The new survey says Americans not associated with any formal religious tradition are as numerous in the nation as Catholics and evangelicals. The general social survey shows slightly more than 23% of people questioned claim they have no organized religion. That compares with 23% who identify as Catholic and 22.5% who identify as evangelical. Those are now the three biggest religious or, if you will, non-religious groupings in the nation. For USA Radio News, I'm Chris Barnes.
USA Radio News.
America's built and based on liberties and freedoms. Liberty HealthShare brings that to healthcare. The liberty of choosing your own doctor. The liberty of choosing your own hospital. Liberty HealthShare makes healthcare affordable to millions of Americans. Ignite your liberty. Sharing plans starting at $199 for a single, $399 for a couple, and no matter how big the family, only $529. That's $529 for the entire family. To learn how you can save, go to lightyourliberty.com. That's lightyourliberty.com.
Thursday, President Trump signed an executive order that requires college campuses to protect free speech. He explains why.
Today's action is just the beginning of our efforts to protect free speech and advance our students' rights agenda. What I've been witnessing over the last long period of time, long before I became president, what I've been witnessing is outrageous.
Colleges and universities would risk losing their federal grant money if they do not provide and protect all speech on college campuses, which, according to Campus Reform's media director Cabot Phillips, has been needed for a long time.
For too long, there has been no accountability. Universities have been able to gobble up billions of dollars in taxpayer money and at the same time routinely deny free speech rights to students. I've been on over 100 college campuses in the last 3 years with the Leadership Institute's Campus Reform, and I've seen firsthand what it looks like. It might be universities telling students, well, you only have free speech, First Amendment rights in these free speech zones, which are oftentimes no larger than a parking spot on an entire campus. I've seen conservative groups lose funding from the university because they don't agree ideologically with them. I've seen speakers be disinvited. I've had to face these kind of threats personally from administrators, professors, students. Right now, on college campuses, free speech is not welcome. They're not a marketplace of ideas where debate is encouraged. And I do think it's important for the president to step in, use his bully pulpit to say, if you're taking federal money, you have to defend the Constitution.
You can find us on Facebook at USA Radio. For USA Radio News, I'm Tim Berg.
Hello, this is Nicole Smith, host of Happy to Help. Would you like to discover the secret to happiness? I talk to volunteers, executive directors, fundraisers, and authors about how nonprofit engagement enriches their lives. We thrive when we have a sense of purpose in our lives. Philanthropy is the new community. Tune in to Happy to Help every Wednesday at 10 a.m. to discover how to find your purpose and live well by doing good.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, WHCR-DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
Hi, and I'm Pat Smits, somewhat out of breath. Sorry, I'm starting late because I was in court, and unfortunately an interpreter was busy in another courtroom, so we didn't get started. So what I expected to be an hour turned out, obviously, much longer. So this is, as I said, I'm Pat Smith's program, It's the Law. And let me tell you a little bit about the weather, first of all. Today, it was supposed to be mostly cloudy. Actually, it started out not nice this morning, but this afternoon seems to, the sun is out. But we do have about a 40% chance of thunderstorms. Tonight, about a 50% chance of thunderstorms, and then a slight chance of showers. However, weekend looks great. Mostly sunny tomorrow, high of about 47 degrees. And then on Sunday, a sunny Sunday, high of about 58 degrees. So looks like it'll be a nice day to get outside and either work in the yard or, better yet, do something fun like hiking or biking, something that's really, start of spring. We certainly need it. So as I am still out of breath, let's see. Well, I think that last week I had guests on from Volunteer Guardianship One-on-One. I was hoping to have a guest today, and he may get here a little bit later, to talk more about what the surrogate's office here does and how helpful the surrogate is in dealing with all of these matters, certainly guardianship when that's necessary, and dealing with estates. Hopefully he'll make it, but if not, we'll just talk about some of what's happening in the cases that have gone on and have been decided this week. Actually, there have not been many cases that were published cases this week, but I'll be right back after I play a couple spots and get my breath, and we'll talk about at least the cases that have been decided.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, Hunterdon Chamber Radio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business. Advancing Hunterdon is an ever-sharp focus on the growth and prosperity of Hunterdon County's businesses. Advancing Hunterdon engages businesses within and throughout the county that are responsive to a call to action as the next chapter in business success. If your business and organization wants to get engaged, contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. Advancing Hunterdon, a roadmap for economic growth for the business community of Hunterdon.
Well, afternoon again. If you did not listen to the program last week, I think there were many very interesting, interesting information that would be helpful. Also, there is an educational program that is this Wednesday, this coming Wednesday. There will be dinner and a discussion also about addiction in the elderly and then about Medicare. So if anybody is interested out there, I think it'll be a very worthwhile program, no charge. And one of the speakers will be Bob Shanahan, an attorney here in Hunterdon County. But for any more information, just go on the website, volunteer guardianship one-on-one. You can talk to Linda or Cindy. Call my office if you can't find them online. And we'll certainly give you the information. My office number is 908-236-7530. And I think that this is going to be an extremely worthwhile educational program. And so hope to see people there. The other thing that we want to announce is, of course, on April 9th, that's Tuesday, from 8 a.m. until 2 p.m., at Hawk Point Golf Club in Washington, there will be the Women's Leadership Summit. And the morning panel will talk about how to create meaningful partnerships within the community. And the keynote speaker is Megan Lamb from Cisco Cisco Systems. And then they're going to be breakout sessions. And then one will be on reputation management and public relations. There will be a second breakout for social media and advertising with our own Audrey Kirshner. If you haven't heard her, she's really, you know, very good. I actually don't know the person who's heading the breakout session, reputation management and public relations. But then the third breakout is managing your personal brand using LinkedIn, and the person handling that one, Karen, is with Upheaval Media / Good Girls Get Rich. Should be interesting. And in any event, the summit includes breakfast and lunch. And to register, just contact the Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce at 908-782-7115. Or www.hunterdonchamber.org. And I think that every one of these leadership summits have been really, helpful as far as the information and just meeting other women in this area who are business people or starting businesses or someone who just really wants to get this information working for a company. So I highly recommend signing up for that if you have any time. And again, it's Tuesday, April 9th, 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Hawk Point Golf Club. I always hate it when somebody gets an announcement. I don't hear when it is, but then I hear what it's about, and I'd like to hear more. So again, I always want to hear again at the end when it's being held. And this is going to be sponsored through the Chamber. So, there's obviously some news, and one of the things is what happens when a company or a nonprofit goes bankrupt. And right now we have the trustees of the Newark Watershed Conservation and Development Corporation have asked the judge in U.S. Bankruptcy Court for a break from its obligations relating to the agency's insolvent pension plan. Now, many pension plans that are what we call ERISA plans, that they're handled through the federal government, not the pension plans, but they have to conform to certain things. And if the pension plan is insolvent, there is an ability to get at least some benefits through as a result of ERISA. But that is only for private companies, and not everyone. If some of the plans, there was the big plan
and I'm just losing who it was, big company in New York that invested everything in their own stock, went bankrupt, and all the employees lost. So this is a problem, obviously, because anyone working for a company participating in the pension expects after their years of labor to get a pension or get a or actually have money in a 401k. I've talked about this before because people often don't understand the difference between a pension and a pension and a retirement plan, etc. Well, there are two kinds. Well, actually, there's more than that. But in general, what's important to know is if the person has a defined benefit plan or a defined contribution plan. Not going to spend a lot of time talking about it today, but the difference is a defined benefit plan means that depending on the number of years the person works, their salary, and certain other factors, they will get a certain amount per month after they retire, after a certain age. In other words, some plans allow an earlier retirement for less money, kind of like Social Security. Think of it that way, because there will be a defined benefit that hopefully all of us will get when we retire or when we reach retirement age. Now, I'm not saying that private pensions are like Social Security, but it's the idea that you will get a certain amount when you retire, and that'll be monthly. Now, of course, with Social Security, it's adjusted, and if you retire early, you take a real hit. Same thing with private pensions. With a defined contribution plan, and in some ways, I guess we could say Social Security is like a defined contribution plan, because it is true, it does depend on the amount that you as an employee and your employer contribute and for the number of years that you contribute. So from that standpoint, I guess it might be considered more like a defined contribution plan. So what happens in a defined contribution plan, of course, I think of it more as a more comparable to a bank account. Because if you put money in a bank account, although you don't have to put a certain amount in, at some point there's an amount of money there and that you will be able to take it out. And in fact, you'll have to start taking it out at a certain time. So for someone who said, well, I'm not going to need the money. I'm going to continue to work until I'm 80 years old, both with Social Security and with 401k plans, the defined contribution plans, you have to start taking out, depending on your life expectancy, you have to start taking out money. Well, Social Security starts paying, obviously, at a certain time. But with a private plan, you have to start taking out yearly a certain amount starting at age 71 and a half. And it does depend on your life expectancy. And there's certainly some other rules. For example, if you have a spouse who's significantly younger, that makes a difference as to the amount that you have to take out. But in this case, we have whoever the employees of the Newark Watershed Conservation and Development Corporation, they're bankrupt, and they're trying to get a break from the obligations that they owe their employees, and because their plan is insolvent. And many times, or certainly it shouldn't happen, but also small plans can be underfunded. And that's a particular problem with defined benefit plans, that the plan does not have enough money so that when employees begin to retire, they will not be able to, meaning the plan will not be able to pay what they thought it would be pain. And that's why it's important to at least find out if your plan is covered through ERISA. Okay, that's, let's see what else. I guess a lot of people might be interested in the fact that marijuana legislation is on track for a Monday vote. That's next Monday. And it's a measure to legalize the possession and recreational use of limited amounts of marijuana for adults 21 and older. And that has been approved by two legislative committees. And it's setting the stage for floor votes in both chambers next Monday. There was some question if there was enough support, but at least apparently they think so, because at least it's going to go up for a floor vote. And however, and whatever you think about that legislation, certainly one of the things that's happening is a lot of people are banking on it, and there will be real questions about communities and whether they will agree to allow stores to be set up in the communities. There would be certainly interest among growers, certainly rumors on some of the bigger facilities in Hunterdon County. There's talk about whether or not there would be either purchased or leased to grow marijuana. I think the most of the discussion here would be growing inside rather than outside plots. And frankly, I'm not sure how that legislation and what would be required to get permits, but there will be certainly very strict regulations as to permits given to grow marijuana. And but very lucrative, and certainly that's the expectation based on what's happened in Colorado. So there was a passage of a bill this week with respect to at least it came out of the Assembly Judiciary Committee, and it would protect consumers and provide fairness to all professionals. Certainly is supported throughout the legal community and other professional groups, and it has to do with fairness in professional malpractice insurance and whether or not what the statute of limitations should be. And very, you know, there's probably a lot of controversy, and I'm not going to get into that debate, because as an attorney, I can certainly see the problems with somebody being able to sue and the statute of limitations to sue an attorney. Excuse me. All right, so let's not go into that any further. There was, as I said, there have been a number of cases that have not been published. Certainly still some of interest. There was a statewide commercial cleaning LLC versus the First Assembly of God, and that was a appellate division case, and the plaintiffs appealed in that case from a denial of their motion to vacate the umpire's award and remand the matter to the umpire for consideration of plaintiff's appraisal. And it granted, apparently, the third-party defendant or Mercer Insurance Company of New Jersey's cross motion to declare the umpire's award valid and enforceable and final. And that required the plaintiff to pay Mercer as specified in the umpire's award, then enter judgment against the plaintiff in the amount of $78,000 plus. And that payment had to be made within 15 days. And it also dismissed the action with prejudice as provided for the, apparently in this case there was a mediation agreement. And the plaintiffs also appealed an order that denied reconsideration. So what happens is, in depending on the case, certainly for motions in the courts, there's a possibility to ask the court to reconsider the decision. However, it has to be something specific that the court has alleged to overlook. So in this case, the church building owned by the defendant third-party plaintiff, that was the First Assembly of God, was damaged in a fire. And the plaintiff, Statewide Commercial Cleaning, was hired to perform the initial cleanup and eventually to handle the restoration and reconstruction. So what happened is plaintiff filed suit against the First Assembly and sought unpaid construction costs. The parties subsequently agreed to submit the matter to mediation. And that's the situation why we have an umpire's decision. So they entered into mediation, and they entered, as a result of mediation, into a mediation settlement agreement. And under the terms of the agreement, an appraisal process was established with both parties hiring an appraiser. So what happened is plaintiff's appraiser never submitted an appraisal, and defendants requested that the umpire, So the plaintiff's appraiser never submitted an appraisal, and the defendants requested that the umpire render a decision. And the umpire issued a loss valuation award based on the unopposed appraisal. At issue on appeal was the trial court's enforcement of the appraisal process. So apparently the plaintiff did not dispute that they were contractually bound by the terms of the appraisal process. But they asserted that the umpire refused to allow charges that were mandated by a government unit. Now, the court disagreed and affirmed, and the court found that the purpose of the appraisal process was to have the value of the loss assessed by disinterested third parties. The court reasoned that the umpire's role was to resolve those terms where the appraisers disagreed. But since the plaintiff didn't have an appraiser, the court found that the plaintiff should have diligently pursued its claim by overseeing or replacing its appraiser to ensure that its interests were represented. So there must have been some reason why the plaintiffs did not submit an appraisal. And in any event, they lost. So very important in the situation where, in this case, mediation and entered into a mediation settlement agreement. So what the agreement was to have an appraisal process, and that was established by mediation by agreement. However, that it also, both parties were hiring an appraiser. And so whatever happened with a plaintiff's appraisal, the plaintiff's appraiser never submitted an appraisal. So basically, there was only one appraisal to deal with, and that was why this case turned out the way it did. So that there was a case which, although, again, was not reported, I think it's of interest, and one of the things that people have to be very careful about is, you know, retirement. So this was Williams versus the Board of Trustees of the Public Employees Retirement System, and it was an appellate division case. And in that case, Williams appealed from the defendant's final agency decision setting May 1st, 2016 as the start date of plaintiff's service retirement benefits. And the plaintiff, Ms. Williams, argued that her benefits should have started as of July 1st, 2015, and that was the date that she sought ordinary disability retirement benefits in her June 2015 application. Apparently, however, that application was later canceled when the plaintiff failed to submit the required documentation. So after her application was canceled, plaintiff's counsel requested her matter, and this is, quote, be converted to a service pension as of the date of her retirement, which is July 1st, 2015. That's the quote. Now, the plaintiff formally applied for a service retirement in April 2016 with benefits effective May 2016. Now, although, and this is what's confusing, although plaintiff requested an effective date of July 1st, 2015, defendants used the May 2016 effective date, ruling that once her 2015 application was closed, she was no longer entitled to that effective date as of her, you know, that she couldn't use that earlier date for her retirement, which of course was significant because we're talking about a difference of a year or almost a year. So on appeal, the plaintiff argued the defendant, in an exercise of its discretion, was empowered and obliged to grant her July 1st, 2015 effective date. However, the appellate division rejected that argument and affirmed the defendant's decision, finding that there was no statutory or regulatory authority empowering the defendant to grant a retroactive start date. So that's the question, whether she was entitled to a retroactive start date, which obviously would bring up a concern that what if, in fact, they had given her the benefits retroactive. They couldn't if, in fact, it wasn't provided for in statute or some regulatory authority. So that this is significant from a standpoint of it certainly seems as if they did the only thing they could do, which was use the later date. Now, there's another case, again, employment benefits, and this was, again, an appellate division case where this woman, Justine Branham, appealed from a final decision of the Board of Trustees of the Police and Firemen's Retirement System, and they denied her application for accidental disability retirement benefits. And she began, she became disabled when she slipped and fell on a stairs to work just before her shift began. So the board determined that she was totally and permanently disabled as a result of the fall, but denied her application because the event did not occur during and as a result of her regular and assigned, either her regular duties or her assigned duties. So she appealed, and the administrative law judge found that when she left her home on the day of the accident, she was already on duty awaiting assignment. Very interesting. So the issue was whether when she left her home on the day of the accident, was she already on duty awaiting assignment? The board disagreed and rejected the administrative law judge's factual findings. Now, what people don't understand is these cases are heard by administrative law judges, but the department, or in this case, the Board of Trustees, has a right to reject what the administrative law judge decides and just reject it. And then there is, of course, an appeal because it's the board doesn't have to appeal. The person has to appeal, which is happening here. Then on appeal, Branham argued that the board's rejection of the ALJ's administrative law judge's factual findings and legal conclusions was arbitrary, capricious, and inconsistent with the governing law. And that's the issue, was it? So the appellate division affirmed the decision of the board and found that the Ms. Branham did not qualify for accidental disability retirement benefits because she was still on her commute and had yet to report to her desk. I should say her desk sergeant, to receive her daily assignments. So she was in the building, climbing the stairs, but she had not received her daily assignments. And the appellate court reasoned that she was not performing any function that was connected to her work assignment when she was injured. So, very interesting. Injured, obviously, what they found was on her way to report because she had not yet reported to her desk sergeant to receive the day's assignment. So, she fell on the stairs going into work. If she had her assignment but still hadn't started and fell on her way out of the office, she would have been entitled to accidental disability retirement benefits. Interesting, because I think that probably most people would have assumed that if it happened when she was in the building, but because she fell on the stairs to work just before her shift began, that was considered non-work-related. There's a number of cases, other cases, and I'll come back and we'll talk about some of the other things that have been happening and a couple of criminal law cases. I don't know if anybody's real happy about whether the criminal law cases are reported or not. Nobody wants to be accused of any kind of criminal activity. So let's take a short break, talk at least let some of our sponsors provide some information, and then we'll be back.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunter Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
¿Sabía que de cada cinco personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental? NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios. Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales. NAMI te ofrece grupos de apoyo, educación e información. Nuestro programa educativo de Familia a Familia está dirigido por miembros de NAMI para familiares y amigos de personas que luchan con dificultad de salud mental. Llámanos al 888-803-3413. Recuerda, no estás solo. NAMI está contigo y no hay salud sin salud mental.
Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's physician referral service at 1-800-511-4-HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
Get into it.
Everybody right there.
Get involved.
Everybody, you.
Did you know? The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in. Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. Contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Okay, as I said, there's a criminal case that was approved for publication. Frankly, I'm not sure why, and sometimes we can't understand. Some cases will be approved for publication, and others won't, when it sometimes seems that it's more important for some of the unpublished cases, certainly from an attorney standpoint, that they provide more information and are really something that we would like to use as precedent. Sometimes, as I said, they're so specific that that's why they're not approved for publication. However, there is this criminal law case, I think, is somewhat interesting, perhaps, but very legalistic in some ways, because what there was Mr. Outland appealed his conviction of a second-degree robbery and conspiracy to commit robbery. And that was merged for sentencing to a 16-year term because he was a persistent offender subject to certain rules and regulations. So apparently he was arrested after the police reviewed a surveillance video from a check-cashing store showing him entering the store with two hooded individuals. And the two hooded individuals ran out of the store shortly after entering. Now, an employee of the store testified that she unlocked the security door for the defendant because he customarily brought her coffee, and after which the hooded individuals forced their way into the store and stole $35,000 from the safe. Now, according to this testimony, the employee asked the defendant to call 911, which he eventually did. So, you know, here's the defendant who is accused now of this robbery. He's the one who called 911. So at the trial court admitted the defendant's 911 call recording. And they did that over the state's objection, but then the trial court ruled the state could play redacted portions of the defendant's statements to the police. So apparently he made certain statements to the police, and the prosecution was allowed to provide redacted statements. And also what we call proffer, meaning offer his prior convictions in rebuttal. So, in other words, the prosecutor, because he said, here, I made the 911 call, this shows that I was not involved in it, I actually called the police. Well, then the prosecutor was then able to say, okay, but we want to provide certain statements, parts of certain statements to the jury, and also show his prior convictions to rebut his attempt to show that he's not guilty. So apparently in the statements to the police, the defendant denied culpability, but discussed how easy it would have been to rob the store due to the employee's lax security. So, you know, why he would have said how easy it would be, who knows. And on appeal, the defendant challenged the admission of the state's rebuttal evidence and the trial court's limiting instructions to the jury. Specifically, he argued that his 911 call recording was not hearsay because it was offered to rebut a state witness's testimony that defendant had not called 911, and that therefore the state could not offer his prior criminal history, to impeach him because this was not hearsay. And it, very interesting. Ordinarily, out-of-court statements are hearsay, but in this case, he used this tape to rebut somebody who said he did not make the call, and this did show that he had made that 911 call. In any event, the appellate court rejected defendant's argument and affirmed the conviction, finding that the witness did not testify that defendant had not made the call, the 911 call, but merely she did not observe him making the call. Very different. The appellate division ruled that the 911 call was offered to prove the defendant's innocence. That's what anybody would have assumed. And, of course, what he said on appeal, it was only offered to rebut her testimony that he had not made the call. But the transcript obviously showed that what she testified is she did not observe him making the call. So the appellate court also held that the state could introduce rebuttal evidence to show that the 911 call was made to exonerate the defendant from involvement, and that the trial court properly instructed the jury on the use of the rebuttal testimony, the rebuttal evidence. So he's saying, well, it's very interesting because in some ways he did not say, look, this is my 911 call that proves my innocence, because he had the problems of prior convictions. So from that standpoint, interesting, because, of course, that's why you'll find that most defendants in criminal cases, you know, their lawyers at least tell them not to testify, because then it can, all the other bad stuff that they've done can be brought up. There was a family law case, actually. Again, it's this appellate division case. And interesting from this standpoint is, be very careful as to what you do and with respect to agreements. And let me tell you why. So in this case, Mr. Bryant appealed from an order requiring him to contribute to the party's children's college education expenses, so that they, meaning the parties, had divorced in 2001, and months after the judgment of divorce, the court received an unsigned copy of their property settlement agreement, which obliged the parties to contribute to their children's college educations according to their relative financial abilities. So, now, why it was months after that, why it wasn't signed, I'm not sure. But in any event, the defendant, former wife, sought enforcement of that agreement in 2017. So 16 months later, she sought enforcement. Now, apparently, the former husband did not disavow the validity of the agreement, and the trial court ordered the plaintiff to pay his share of both children's college costs. He then moved for reconsideration, asserting that the written agreement did not accurately reflect the agreement placed on the record at the time the judgment of divorce was entered. Now, this is speculation, but I would speculate that perhaps they put something on the record. It wasn't as complete as it should have been. And then they tried to get a written agreement, and nobody could agree on the terms, and somebody just sent it to the court unsigned. Now, obviously, what should have happened is, if they couldn't agree, they should have obtained a copy of the transcript and attached that. But what this also shows, and of course, because this is a family law case and this is the kind of work I do, I think, I can think of only a couple times in my career that I have ever agreed to put an agreement on the record after divorce. And obviously those cases, what we put on was very favorable. Because what often happens is there's a real pressure by the court to get everything done. They want the attorneys to put the agreement on the record. But unless you really have it written out and fleshed out, it's almost impossible to put a comprehensive agreement on the record. So what most attorneys will do is say, well, these are basically the bare bones of the agreement. We will go back and we will submit a written agreement with all of the terms. And then what happens, because I've seen this often when I have people coming back to me after their attorney who represented them during the divorce has done this and they can't agree, then, you know, it becomes a big mess. So, frankly, I don't do that. But what happened in this case is interesting because the plaintiff then had come back saying the written agreement did not accurately reflect the agreement placed on the record at the time of the judgment was entered. Now, the trial court rejected that argument, noting that the plaintiff had moved to enforce various provisions of the agreement when it suited him. So that's what I mean. Be careful what you ask for. So the court rejected the plaintiff's argument, meaning the appellate division, rejected the plaintiff's argument that the trial court was required to hold a plenary hearing to determine whether the written agreement contained the terms agreed on by the parties. So the appellate division in this case, and that's very unusual because usually the appellate division will send these things back for a plenary hearing. But in this case, the appellate division said there was sufficient evidence that the parties had recognized the written agreement as binding on them, and the plaintiff had used the agreement to advance his interests. And the court did agree that the plaintiff was entitled to see the defendant's tax return. So, I mean, I guess that was one of the issues that the trial court had denied. But so that in this case, there was sufficient evidence that they did not have to go back. The trial court did not have to have a hearing as to the terms of this written agreement because the parties themselves had recognized the written agreement as binding. And in this case, the plaintiff had used the agreement to advance his interests. So therefore, didn't make any difference that it wasn't signed, which, as I said, would be very unusual in most circumstances. A PIP claim, insurance law, again, not published, but interesting. But we don't have time to really go into this because it's going to be the end of the show. But just very quickly, in this case, the defendant insurer moved for summary judgment seeking a declaration that she was eligible for PIP benefits under her daughter's policy with the insurer. This was Personal Service Insurance Company. The plaintiff who resided with her daughter was in an automobile accident while driving a vehicle borrowed from the brother of her boyfriend. So she claimed PIP benefits under her daughter's policy, and the insurer denied the claim because plaintiff did not have a valid driver's license at the time of the accident. Kind of interesting. The court noted the matter was ripe for summary judgment because there was no dispute that plaintiff was not a licensed driver. So I guess if you're not a licensed driver, you don't sue for PIP benefits. And the court agreed that with the motion judge that a vehicle owner could not grant permissive usage status to an unlicensed driver. So guess what? Plaintiff lost, and in that case, should have lost. And be very careful out there. Don't let anyone who doesn't have a valid license drive your vehicle. So that's about the end of what we have. I hope to see you next week. Hope I won't be delayed in court, so I'll be here on time. And again, I'm hoping to have someone discuss more about what happens here in the surrogacy court, because it's very interesting. And frankly, people need to know about it. And so many people don't. But if you have any questions, there are some excellent attorneys here in Hunterdon County that deal with these issues.
The news is sponsored by the Hunterdon Medical Center. Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's physician referral service at 1-800-511-4HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.